You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.
Hey, welcome to yet another episode of HR Bandit, the pod where we discuss everything that's new and happening in the world of work. Now, if you've been around here and if you're wondering why I sound raspier than usual, it's because after over 2 years of chasing, COVID finally got up, and what you hear are its last remnants, thankfully. But that aside, we have a very interesting lineup of topics today. Wait for it. You know it. This is our best one yet. First up, Microsoft made news again when they announced 4 changes to further enhance their workplace culture. Tiny big changes, but remarkable impact. For our second topic, super tokenism. This is my favorite for today. A word that's been pushing organizations to think beyond diversity hiring. And finally, for our last topic, we delve a little deeper into the next phase of AI and HR. But along the way, we'll also learn a little bit about angel investing, which has become my new favorite topic of inquiry, for lack of a better word. With that, Bandits, it is time to introduce you to our guest for the day. Devyani Vashampayan is the managing partner for the HR Tech Partnership, which focuses on AI human capital space through 2 ventures. One, an angel investment fund, which invests in AI-based HR tech startups. Now, that I'm definitely interested about. 2, the Human Capital Digital Innovation Lab, which is a 6-month program which helps corporate HR teams learn about AI-based HR startups. Prior to this, Devyani has been an international and multi-sector group CHRO and board member, effectively leading large, diverse, and multi-billion complex organizations. She's held global roles in successful organizations across various industries such as Citibank, AT&T, British Gas, Rolls-Royce, and Petronas. She's lived and worked in China, Singapore, Europe, and is also listed in the Financial Times Ethnic Minority Leaders List and the FTSE 100 Women to Watch List. Devyani, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ankita. It's a bit embarrassing to listen to myself like this, but thank you for the invite. I've listened to your earlier podcasts, and what I've loved about them is it's a real conversation. It's not really a scripted, boring kind of few questions. So I'm looking forward to this.
Devyani, I'm looking forward to our conversation and have been for a while now, especially because I remember we spoke, like, our first conversations, and you were like, who can I connect you with? Let me connect you to XYZ person. And I was like, these are the kind of people I need more in my life. But because you're here and your bio has angel investing in it, I really want to figure, when did you first start thinking about it? Because it's an area where a lot of people are now thinking, we need to do more with our money than let it sit in the bank or put it in real estate.
Yeah, so I think I was very, very lucky. So when I was posted to Singapore, I actually was approached by an organization in India. And so I think India is really the cradle of a lot of creativity. To be one of the first early investors in a small fund with the idea being, the fund was focused on the HR tech space. And naturally, I think I have always been interested in commercial and business. So while I've held HR roles, actually, I have been out of HR doing strategy roles too. But I think my daughter tells me, Mommy, if you were born, I think if you had a chance to redo your career, you would have been an excellent investment banker. So I think it's something that probably I was always interested in. It was not a career option for me 30 years ago. But the fund here gave me a chance to start understanding angel investment. I went on to its board. And I think even at that stage, I knew this is something I definitely want to do at some point in my life. In 2015, I came back to London, where I was based. In a way, I think I started seriously thinking about setting up a fund myself. And I was very lucky because I had some excellent people whom I would regard as role models, mentors, who really not just supported me, but who were one of my first investors. So the whole idea for the fund was to have senior HR professionals as investors, and the investment was going to be in AI-based HR tech startups. So it was a very, very much about domain experts being investors. And so today I have people like the group HR director for BP, the group HR director for Centrica, the group HR director for Balfour Beatty. I mean, these are large FTSE businesses. And these HR folks, who are in a way my peers, my colleagues, but they have invested personal money into it. Now, I say this is amazing because keep in mind that I never had an investment track record. So firstly, for them to have enough confidence to invest personal money, but also for me, it was quite a big steep learning curve because, as you know, the regulatory environment here is very, very strict. So this is not about just getting a group together to invest. This is a formally, it's a formal fund that has been registered with CDERS. With all the financial regulatory kind of requirements, et cetera. But it's been great fun. So, yeah, so that's a little about the fund. And our investment focus has been across any part of the employee life cycle.
It is amazing. And I'll tell you why. Because, and this is not HR. It's just about us being financially aware, which I don't think we're taught anywhere. I didn't even know what angel investing was till a few years ago, because it was such a, like, I moved to Ireland and I was like, where do people put their money? Like, what do you do? And I was thrown with so many recommendations, none of which I understood. And I was like, I'm going to play it safe and just leave it in the bank. But then lately I've been, interacting with a few startups, speaking to other angel investors and people who are interested in that field. And I'm surprised why people aren't talking about this more. So with that, Devyani, I'm going to take us into our first topic for the day, because I'm really excited about what we have. Now, earlier in June, Microsoft announced four big changes that are notable for many reasons. They stated that they'll be removing non-compete clauses from US employee agreements and will not enforce existing clauses in the US, except for Microsoft's most senior leaders. Second, Microsoft's US settlement and separation agreements no longer include confidentiality language that prohibits workers from disclosing alleged conduct that they perceive as illegal discrimination, harassment, retaliation, sexual assault, or a wage and hour violation occurring in the workplace. Microsoft will also publicly disclose salary ranges in all internal and external job postings across the US, beginning no later than January 2023. And finally, they will conduct a civil rights audit. Now, mind you, for a global organization, this is all very US specific, but one's got to start somewhere. And the hope is that success in one region spreads to others and spreads to other organizations too. Devyani, in my opinion, there's a fair bit to applaud in what's changing. But I'm curious, is there one of these four that stand out for you more than the rest?
Well, I think firstly, as you said, I think all four are good starts. I wouldn't particularly say that they have been proactive in doing this. There's also contextual environment, particularly the one I think that strikes me as which could make a real difference is the one which prohibits employees about, non-disclosure provisions. And it's going to make it easier to create an environment that everyone claims to want to achieve, which is fair, diverse, inclusive, safe. So I think that the second one that you mentioned for me is definitely something that is going to drive the right culture and behaviors. Again, keeping in mind that the context for this has been a little more legal. So I don't know if people are aware, but in March 2022, the Washington governor, Jay Inslee, signed the Silence No More Act. And that act law went into effect on Thursday, June 9th, a day after Microsoft announced this policy change. So clearly there was, I think they were preparing themselves for this. But equally, in 2021, Microsoft shareholders voted for a report into the effectiveness of the company's sexual harassment policies. Now, that's quite serious. If the board is asking you to, you know, has voted to say that the more investigation is needed, it's obviously an area of control. So I do think the right steps are being taken. But clearly, some of this is in response to some pushback, either from the law or from the board, but all good direction. It's all in the right direction, definitely.
I agree. We briefly mentioned the law in our episode in March, actually, where we talked about governments and legislation in general and how they are going to dictate the future for organizations. And I think this is very timely because, well, we are in June and talking about it. But I do think there is something in them making an announcement over it. I love how they're controlling the narrative of it all. But it's natural to now say, Microsoft is doing this. Now, is Google going to, like, Google Jobs been talking about publicly disclosing salary pay ranges, for example, for a very long time. And you're like, are they going to come out and do it? Or is this just like a Google Jobs thing where everyone else shares their pay, but they don't? And we've talked about publicizing pay ranges also in a while. I'm going to, for a second, because you're on the board of so many organizations, I'm going to also ask you about what you think about the non-compete clauses, because in my opinion, they're pretty much useless and extremely prohibitive, because if you're going from an organization like Microsoft, you'll most likely go to a competitor and you can't. What do you think about them taking this off?
So firstly, I guess, you know, I used to work in the software industry in India many years ago. This is almost 30 years ago with Citicorp, Citibank. And at a time, it was a very, very competitive environment because you really didn't have the skills available. So anyone who even had a little bit of experience was immediately in demand and could easily be poached. And even at that time, I think as an organization, we made the conscious decision that we would not have non-compete clauses. And I think the emphasis was, how do you really retain people rather than, you know, force them or prohibit them from leaving? I think that those are two very different approaches. So personally, my personal view is I'm not in favor of these kind of clauses. You know, if you don't have the right job, if employees don't feel engaged, if you're not paying them well, it would be very natural for them to go, and then forcing them through these means is probably, that means you're not doing your job properly. Also, I think in the US, at times, while this may be a deterrent on paper, enforcing it is not as easy as it seems. But equally, I do think this is by making this, taking this approach now, Microsoft is in effect saying that they are willing to trust employees much more. It is going to be really an environment where skills, talent are going to be respected far more rather than treated as a scarce resource who has to be kept in prison. So definitely it's a step in the right direction. And it is clearly, I think, with the scarcity of digital. So I think there's a couple of market trends now which is going to make this more important. The first is there is, you know, the pressure on salaries is going to go up. You know, there's wage inflation happening. There's scarce skills, which is a lot of organizations especially need digital technology skills, which means, and there isn't enough supply. But equally, I think now with hybrid working, remote working, access to these skills from other sources is going to happen in a very different way. So I think all this is going to shake up the market quite a bit. And so I think it is brave of Microsoft to put this in place at a time when the market is going to get more demanding. But equally, I do think it's in the right direction. Yeah.
I love that. I think you're right in saying that there are a lot of macroeconomic factors at this point of time that are influencing organizations to really make changes. Okay, so that's about Microsoft. I think we've given them a fair bit of airtime.
You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.
I'm going to move to a topic where we'll probably spend a little more time. And this is super tokenism. It is a term that is fast becoming my favorite word of the month. It is something that I was introduced to only this month. Bandits, I'll link all articles that we are referring to in the show notes. And this particular Fast Company article describes the phenomena well. In short, super tokenism is when talented people from marginalized identities are used to bring to surface diversity to an organization, but not necessary inclusion. And well, for marginalized societies, definitely not decolonization. Now, take the example of hiring. It is us using the same hiring measures to determine what a successful hire will look like, even if it does not really fit people from marginalized identities. What super tokenism is pushing organizations to do is truly break down barriers and change how we do things today so that it includes a wider population. Devyani, in this space, I think the role of boards becomes even more important. And I'm curious to ask, have you seen examples of where this is done well? And how do you see their role in pushing to create an inclusive space?
So definitely, I think, you know, for any change to happen, it has to start at the top. And for me, in any organization, the board is really at the apex. You then have the senior leadership team, and then you have the rest of the organization. But I know it sounds very hierarchical, but that is a reality in most organizations. And so I think when you're talking about driving D&I inclusive culture, what is very easy to say, oh, let's bring in more graduates who look different. Or I think that's fine. That's important. But the change has to start at the board level. And I think the UK is a great example of driving this change. Now, Mike, of course, for me, the real role model is Norway or Scandinavian, which were far earlier and have driven gender diversity in a very drastic way. So overnight, I think boards had to have at least half or more than half of the board as women. But in the UK, I think what they've done is they've also been working at it quite systematically. So in 2016, the Alexander Hampton Review stipulated that you needed to have more women on boards. Now, this was not about quotas, but this was making a very clear statement and a very clear intent of having at least one third of the board as women. But along with that, there's been a lot of other things in the ecosystem alongside working with search firms, making sure that there was development, giving publicity to this. So I think if you look at targets do make a difference. And by 2020, the target of 33% of women on boards was achieved in all FTSE 350 organizations. Now, that's quite remarkable. Okay, and today it's 37% of women on boards. So I think it's a good example of driving gender diversity. The second thing the UK started looking at board diversity was ethnic representation, because it is, you know, I think in the UK you do have a fair level of its population. And so you had the Parker Review, which is then again looking at do boards. And currently the requirement is for FTSE 100 companies, you have at least one member. I think what is very effective is a lot of publishing and reviewing who's doing it and who's not. So in a way, naming and shaming, to put it very crudely, but that does make a difference. But going back to your point about super tokenism, how does it help? Super tokenism also happens when you have just a very small proportion. So if you want to have, you know, more women, more ethnic members, if you want to have someone from socially kind of or disabled or neurodiverse, you know, there are all different aspects of diversity. But if you just have one individual, two individuals, it's very difficult for them. So unless you have a certain mass of people, the change doesn't happen. And I think what, especially on boards now, there is a well-established kind of almost research and practice over the last 8-10 years of driving this change through, which has been very successful. So I do think that one example is to come up with an area, make sure that there's a proper kind of body that's looking into it, but then come up with almost some kind of targets. And then ensuring that these are publicized, supported, reviewed, so that then there is enough momentum happening to make this change happen. I think the second thing that boards are doing here, which I think is helping this whole space, is having one board member who's the workforce engagement lead. Now, this is very unusual. Typically on boards, you know, you usually have REMCO and then they are focused on compensation. But workforce engagement really means focus on the culture, focus on the talent pipeline, and having one person who's looking more into it. And again, I think in terms of improving diversity, making sure it's not just ticking the box, making sure it's not super tokenism, I think that is making, because that individual really dives deep and gets make sure, but there's regular understanding, reporting, you know, making sure. And the Microsoft, again, is a great example. I think I raised this earlier. One of the reasons why they've come up with the changes is because the board brought this up as an area. So I think super tokenism will always exist. Change is difficult. People don't want to change the status quo. But if there's pressure, they will do something to show that it's happening. But for real change to happen, you need enough, again, as I said, a bigger group of people representing that change. Otherwise, it's difficult.
That is very valuable. Here's what I was thinking, though. I think we have said that there are targets and, you know, you need to bring in a more diverse population into a certain space. But we're using the same processes. And, you know, my contention with super tokenism is this, that the processes are the same. So, for example, you want someone who has a master's degree or a PhD who has work experience in certain XYZ spaces. And say for the marginalized community, and I'm going to take the example of the author of this article that brought it to my attention. Now, that person's Black and he is different from what he says most people, because if you were to look at the majority of Blacks, they don't have a master's degree and a PhD. They don't have the kind of work experience or the amount of publications that the person does. And he's a super token in that way because he is just a very rare person in that community. Now, if you did want to be inclusive, you would have to break down those requirements. You say, this is not what we're going to do. Like, the job requires a certain artistic capability. So I'm going to go to, for example, a graffiti artist on the street and ask him his views and like use those reach outs to say who can do that job. Now, if we were to put targets, we're not doing that. We're just searching for these, in my head, super tokens. And whoever passes that filter comes in and we're like, okay, job done, dusted, move on. And I think I don't see enough of that happening.
But I think that's not entirely true, because I think what it does is it forces you to look at people who are different. Mm-hmm. And it also forces you to think about what does the role really need? What are the skills rather than what's the background? Is this a traditional career path they've come from? So I'm not saying it's necessarily true, but I think this is where headhunters play a very important role, because particularly for mid to senior level roles, you know, you normally have a headhunter. And if you have a headhunter who's able to understand what the role needs, understand that the talent pool may look different, but almost be that bridge between helping the client understand, influence them, and make sure that the right match is happening, I think that's for senior level roles. Now, for more entry level roles, I think you know, technology is making a big difference, because, as you know, I think in many of the big organizations now in the UK, a lot of personal information is redacted. So, which university you come from is not important. You know, university, sex, which part of the country, your ethnicity, your name. I think a lot of that is redacted. And then the emphasis then shifts on to the skills that you have. And then, of course, assessing those through various means. So I do think that there is some level of an awareness, but equally, I think trying to do it on your own is very difficult, and there are some mechanisms to support and aid this. And particularly, I think at the where there's more volume, technology can play a big role in helping you source and look at diversity in a very different way.
Absolutely. I'm going to share a very quick anecdote, and then I'm going to come back to something that you said. We were speaking to this candidate, and the person was really, really good. Like, every interview they aced. However, every time it came to like a test, like a coding test and so on, they drastically failed. And for this organization, it was a requirement And we kept wondering, like, do we need it? Like, there was a huge push to just reevaluate, because we realized after, like, no one was to say it, but the person had exam anxiety, and which is why the grades, like, if you look at their academic record, it was miserable, but they were actually really smart. And then you were like, do we change the system for this one person? But I think it's hard to do. And like, ideally, I would like to say we should do it. Like, for this individual, we do it. But a lot of times, we don't even recognize these people, because like, a lot of organizations have coding tests as part one. Now, there's a huge debate. Do we remove it? Because then the whole process becomes more expensive. Or do we just... So I agree. I think we are thinking differently. But there are also, you know, sometimes economies of scale that play in. And we need to push to change that mindset. But I'll come back to the part of what you said, technology, because I do think technology has a huge part to help make that happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to combine the two things that you really enjoy. I know you're very passionate about inclusion, and I know AI is a big area of interest. And you said technology can help. So do you see AI playing a role in just helping create more inclusive spaces?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, firstly, I think I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today. I mean, I was a very successful CCHRO and then to turn into an entrepreneur. But to focus on AI meant that I genuinely truly believe that AI is going to play a huge role at the workplace, and particularly is going to be very useful to HR professionals. But I think specifically, so I guess just a little background about the Innovation Hub. What we do is, as I said, we help corporates pilot an AI solution around any aspect of people management, particularly the software areas. Now, which means we are like a marketplace. And so we have a product team that is continuously scanning the environment for good solutions. But then we vet and we assess the solution to ensure that it's fit for purpose. And really, from a user perspective also, does it really solve a real issue? Because it's not about fancy tech. It's really about a user perspective. Is it scalable? You know, is it available in languages? And all the other things that we see. And then once we have that, so we have a portfolio now of a couple of hundred such solutions. And like I said, there are all the softer aspects of people management. Now, D&I is clearly a big area, in particular in the UK and many parts, you know, in the Western world. And organizations are looking for help around it. And what we've seen is there's some great solutions that can help you use that. So I think technology is very useful. So it starts with, you know, the whole recruitment process, because that's invariably your talent where a lot of the bias happens. So you have solutions that can remove bias in job ads. You know, automatically it can scan and make sure. You have solutions that can access very different talent pools, that can source CVs very speedily, but then also, you know, match the skill set rather than, so read that personal information, match skill set to the jobs actually needed. And then from an engagement perspective, keep the candidate engaged so that people who are feeling not very sure, you know, are not used to this, are handled a little more. But equally, I think once you bring the candidate or employee inside the organization, there could be some different support mechanisms needed for people from slightly different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And so whether it is personalized training, whether it's reverse mentoring, there's a whole lot of AI solutions now that are available. Not a whole lot, I should say, but there's a good range of AI solutions available, which can really support you in creating an inclusive, you know, bring in inclusive talent, but making sure also that they stay engaged and retain them. And of course, then you have aspects of pay equality, but also, you know, in terms of culture on an ongoing basis, using organization network analysis to figure out, are there issues, are there risks? So for me, AI and technology can play a huge, huge role around this area, and particularly for organizations where there's volume, there's speed needed, it can make a real difference.
So let's segue into AI and talk a little more about that, because one of the biggest questions I've had in this space is, how transparent should your algorithm be? Mm. Right, because that's the best way to check for biases or any errors, because making it public and transparent allows people to spot the gaps from different communities or whoever and be able to call it out. Yet, at least a lot of models I've seen hold their algorithms very close and not necessarily say, it's up for scrutiny. It's available here. Like, if you help us, like, fix the defects. And in space of HR, I think that's really important, because you have to strike a balance between making it transparent so that people can catch gaps, but also ensure that you're not breaching any morality or ethical boundaries. What do you think of that? Like, how transparent should it be? Are you a proponent for saying, if it's an AI system, the algorithm needs to be transparent?
I haven't heard of any organization which is totally transparent about its algorithm. So I don't know if it's happening. And maybe if you know someone, it would be great to know who's doing it. But I guess it's difficult. I mean, again, I've been an organization professional myself. So I'm really approaching it from a practical perspective rather than a moral ethical perspective. Firstly, I do think this space is evolving. It's not as if we have reached, you know, so I think it's still a place where people are using it to figure out, and which is why I think the approach we always recommend is start small, experiment, review it, don't make any big changes. But before you do that, I think it's also important to look at your current processes, because I think the thing with AI is, if you have a bias in your current process and you don't change that, automatically you're going to transfer that. So I think it's more about not the algorithm, but really your approach, the organization's approach to using it, which needs to be cautious, which needs to be, you need to check, you need to validate, and you need to roll it out slowly. And through that, you also need to track what's not, you know, whom are you rejecting, for example, what's the pool like, and which is the whole process of testing and validation. So if you were to ask me, I think making it totally transparent at this stage would be quite challenging for most organizations, given that it's still early stages for many of them.
I agree. Like, I am not aware of someone who's made their algorithms totally open. I was at a talk by Lawrence Moroni, who's the AI lead at Google. And I think they brought up, like, the very famous example of where Google did its image processing. It classified a lot of blacks automatically into categories that they shouldn't. Yeah. And it wasn't until it was out in public and everyone was looking at the output that they realized that the algorithm was mistaken. And then since then, he's been a proponent of, had we made the algorithm open earlier, we would have caught this before it had a large-scale impact. So I know there are AI experts and leads from organizations who are now going earlier into schools, colleges, to modify curriculum, but also saying, if you have an algorithm, if you can make it public, because open source is the way to quickly iterate and improve. But you're also right, like, organizations have so many work-related guidelines and policies that we're not willing to talk about openly, right? Like, we're so protective about them. I cannot imagine making algorithms public. So then, Devyani, how do we check for morality and ethics early in adopting AI? Like, what's the downside of adopting it too quickly?
Well, I think firstly, going back to the example you gave, it again ties in with the earlier issue raised about super tokenism. Now,
exactly.
The example you gave, if they had enough diverse people in the team, this would have been very apparent much earlier, right? And so I do think for some of these issues, organizations need to think hard about, you know, rather than quick fixes about making it transparent, actually, what's the real issue? Do we have the right people? Do we have enough diverse thinking? Do we have, which reflects our customer base, really? So I think there's that. But going back to ethics, I mean, firstly, I think that there are, you know, we've covered the bit about, you cannot rush into it. You have to check. You have to check what you've done previously. I think the other almost hotspot in terms of ethics is, you know, personal violation. Now, with customers, where do you stop you know, what is the point at which it's not ethical? And similarly, now the issues arising with employee violation. You know, what's the level of privacy they need to have? How much of it can you use? So for me, that's the other aspect of ethics that organizations have to start thinking of much more. And this is not an issue they had to face earlier because it was box standard data held in the HRIS and that's it. So the whole aspect of data insights, what you're getting from it, and individual and customer privacy or employee and customer privacy is the second aspect of ethics, I think, that is becoming very important.
That's true. Can you tell me, I'm going to shift tracks a little bit, what is the coolest thing that's happening in AI at the moment?
Gosh, I'm not the right person then because I don't really go for the coolest thing. You know, I go for what can be adopted, what can be useful right now, which means it's kind of in there. But I think in general, I still am for HR professionals, I think what's not been tapped into very much, and I see that as important and relevant, is virtual reality. And of course, what I have seen are some very good solutions around training and coaching. But I do think an induction, you know, it's been used for inducting new people. It's been used for training both around, you know, products, factories. But I think for me, the exciting piece is really the soft skills, leadership, culture aspect. And I've seen some good solutions. I do think, it's not so much about cool, but I think the ability then to learn for in your own personal space, but to have real feedback and to do it in a cost-effective manner is something. And so I find that, I think that my prediction is that's the space that you should be watching out for over the next 5 to 7 years.
Virtual reality. Mm. Absolutely. Now, we've also heard many ridiculous things about AI, right? I think I can share a few stories, but they're like so outrageous that you wonder who said. What's the one thing you heard about AI so far that like literally made you roll your eyes and laugh?
Well, I think the one thing that, you know, people do, of course, I think concerns, I'm sure you've ethics and all. So particularly in HR, people have this perception, but HR is very about people. How can you use AI in HR or for leadership, for culture? But the one thing that I've heard, which also makes me smile a little, is it makes humans lazy. Now, you know, on one hand, yes, technology, you can say technology makes you lazy, but actually it should be able to make you think and therefore apply your mind in a more intelligent way. And I think one analogy which I hear even now from, you know, is when we grew up, or when, you know, a lot of older people grew up, your times tables were important, so you did it in your head, and people feel that is the way it should be. And the perception is, oh, today's younger generation is really lazy because they need a calculator for even the smallest calculation. So, and for me, I think that's the kind of example that probably AI has, you know. So the question is it really more important to be able to get the answer using a calculator, or is it actually the application of that knowledge then to all the various things you're doing in your life, which makes you then able to make some more intelligent decisions? And so I think it's the same with AI. People think, people don't, things are told to them, they just follow it blindly. But I do think that's not entirely true. I think AI has the ability to actually make you make more intelligent decisions and not just make you lazy.
Devyani, with the whole multiplication thing, I think you called out a personal bias of mine.
I know, even I have that sometimes. So, yeah.
Because I was at this Van Gogh digital experience recently. And
I've been to that, yeah.
Yeah, and they had I think it's a total propaganda. Like, I don't think I was as amazed as I thought I would be. But then they used the AI to analyze all his works of art so far and then recreate what he would have created today. And I was sitting there being like, either this is really cool or this is total blasphemy, because like machines shouldn't be creating art for us. And like, if it's an art created by a machine, is it still art or is it something else? Like, I just sat there in confusion for a while and I'm like, I have no idea what's happening anymore. So
that's true. And I think the metaverse is going to change things even more. So yeah.
Devyani, I'm going to have to get us out of here. It's been a great conversation and we could, like, there's so many other topics I would love to talk to you about. But before I let you go, because you've been talking about technology, AI, and so on, what's the latest gadget that you have invested in?
I think you're asking the wrong person. I'm not really a gadget person at all. In fact, I've been trying to really declutter and make things very simple. But yeah, the one thing I have ordered actually just yesterday, which should arrive today, is a Logitech Litra Glow. It's really, put very simply, it's a light that helps you on Zoom calls, but which makes you, it's adapted to different skin tones, diffuse the light. Just, I think Zoom calls are now here to stay. I've resisted. I had another contraption which I felt was not very good. So yeah, if you call that a gadget, then that's the latest one that I have ordered.
For me, anything that runs on electricity is likely a gadget. Yeah. Like, I've been eyeing an air fryer now and I'm like, should I buy it? Should I not buy it? This is going to change my life. But Devyani, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here. I think you've said a fair bit that makes me want to go back, read a little more, understand it better. I think that's really valuable. Before you go, any last words?
Oh, gosh. No, I think, firstly, I think what you're doing is great. I do think these podcasts, there's so much now, there's so much change happening, but there's also ways to keep up. So, and a conversation like this is definitely easy to get into, but to also just pick up a few things. So thank you for that and continue doing the great work. If anyone wants to reach out for anything, whether it's, angel investment, whether it's boards, which is really a big focus of mine, any other advice, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.
Absolutely, Devyani. Bandits, all Devyani's contacts, LinkedIn, Twitter, and email ID will be in the show notes. With that, on behalf of NHRD and Devyani and I, we are out.
You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.